This episode is sponsored by Paleo Valley's pasture-raised chicken sticks. I'm super excited to share Paleo Valley's brand new pasture-raised chicken sticks. These chicken sticks are made from 100% pasture-raised chicken and organic spices that are preserved using natural fermentation rather than preservatives. So yes, no fake stuff or additives here. These chicken sticks are sourced from regenerative family farms raised on American pastures, and each stick is free of chemicals, antibiotics, pesticides, and added hormones. Paleo Valley's chicken sticks are a perfect snack packed with 7 grams of protein and, frankly, a great value without skimping on quality. Make sure to support this podcast and head over to paleovalley.com/NWJ and use code NWJ to get 15% off your order. Thanks again for listening and supporting this podcast. Hey guys, it's Judy from Nutrition with Judy. Thanks for joining me today. My name is Judy Cho and I'm board certified in holistic nutrition. Today is a very different type of episode. It is a episode that is filled with information like most Nutrition with Judy interviews, and there's a lot of powerful packed information that will help you benefit and possibly get to root cause healing. But beside that, we have decided to honor Dr. Al Dannenberg, who has recently passed away. Dr. Al Dannenberg was diagnosed with cancer in 2018 and was only given a few months to live. And he said, no, I'm not going to accept this diagnosis, and then fought for the next 5 years to use other modalities to live longer. And he really did. He has been an advocate because of that and has vocally shared how diet and other modalities has really helped him to live longer. We were lucky enough to have Dr. Dannenberg well enough to be part of the Carnivore Summit, our very first Carnivore Summit, and he interviewed with one of our Carnivore Summit interviewers, Heather. You'll see in the interview that he has so much life and gusto for what he advocates for. In the conversation, they talk a lot about oral health and how gut health and oral health are so connected, and how in order to have optimal health, both of them need to be in good function. And then he shares some controversial stuff about amalgams. It's a very fascinating interview. While I wasn't able to do this interview myself, we decided as a company that we wanted to share this interview because we really wanted to uplift Dr. Dannenberg and just have his content out there so that more and more people can learn about his advocacy and just his heart and his passion. As I was preparing for this interview, I went on his website and saw a letter to the community about his life's transition, and I wanted to share a little bit about it. For my followers, I sincerely thank you and appreciate your many encouraging comments throughout my cancer journey starting in 2018. Life's transition. Our moments of life transition is when our souls leave our body at death. This is a topic most societies shun. In the medical profession, we do almost everything to stay alive and keep our patients alive. We engage our patients to take care of themselves and teach a myriad of proactive steps to wellness. All this is done to be the best we can be as we pursue our journey on earth. But all of us come to the end of our story. All of us must die. But how do we prepare for death? How do we make dying as beautiful as our years of living? How do our loved ones adjust? What happens after we die? Preparation for death is the ultimate moment that gets us almost no attention, but is experienced by everyone at some point in time. Death must be a topic that is discussed openly and candidly before a person dies. Rarely is this done in our society today. I embrace death and dying as the beautiful end to one's life journey. We come into this world alone and we leave this world all alone. It's not sad, it's just the way it is. But the time spent in between these events define us. Pay attention to your gut health, make dental health a priority. Eliminate things that you know are bad for you, even if the FDA allows them to remain in our lives. Making these changes to your daily life will help empower you to retain your good health for as long as possible. And take it from me, your health is the most priceless form of wealth. God bless. From Dr. Al. I wanted to share little snippets of his letter, and I'll put in the show notes where to find the full open letter to the community. I think it is important to talk about death because we will all experience it in one moment of our lives. And I think it's something that we should embrace and understand that it's a part of life and not be scared by it. We just wanted to celebrate Dr. Al and all the work that he provided. We, in our Carnivore Summit, asked every speaker for any free content or papers that they had so that we can share it with our community. And Dr. Al was one of the first to send many different articles that he wanted, or handouts that he wanted us to share with the community. So we are going to share everything that he has done so that his work can live long. While this intro is sombering, we're really just trying to celebrate Dr. Al and for all the work that he has put out there. I have also interviewed him a couple years ago, and I will also put that in the show notes. He is a remarkable educator. He's entertaining, and he is not someone that will withhold words. Let's get right into the interview.
I just want to welcome you to the Carnivore Summit. I am so excited that you're here, and I'm excited that I get to interview you and have all of our participants get to listen and learn from you. It's a real treat for us. So I have a whole list of questions here to ask you, but before we begin, would you mind introducing yourself and telling everyone how you kind of became acquainted with the low-carb, carnivore, ketovore community?
Well, for me to get to where I am is a story of me understanding paleo 7 or 8 years before I was diagnosed with cancer. And then cancer brought me to paleo autoimmune, and then eventually to a very strict carnivore diet. And that whole thing was related to me having a diagnosis of a incurable bone marrow cancer in 2018, with 3 to 6 months prognosis to live. I rejected chemo, went on to my research, and eventually landed on a strict carnivore, which I began again on January 1st, 2020, which I am not exactly strict carnivore today, but I would say 80, 90% carnivore.
So my first question is, what can our oral health tell us about our overall health? Why is that so vital?
I think you're getting the cart before the horse.
Okay.
So let me tell you what I believe is involved with oral health, because I think oral health is part of the continuum of the either success or failure of the gut microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were to start with oral health, like almost every biological dentist does, you miss an important segment that never gets treated. So do you want me to start?
Yes,
in the beginning?
Us. Yes.
So first of all, I'm very controversial, meaning that a lot of people don't agree with me until they start to understand the research. There's no research that says 1 and 1 is 2. It does show a lot of informative medical pieces of information. We'll just call them a bunch of dots, and I'm trying to connect the dots. So here's my description of all these medical dots. You know, Hippocrates, I don't know how many 1,000, 1,500 years ago, said that all disease starts in the gut. He got it right. He got it right then. Everybody that discounted his knowledge is now coming about and saying, well, you know, he may have gotten it right. He got it right. Here's the deal from what I gather and what I understand from research. We're made of 38 trillion microbes. Most of them are in our gut. And some of and our human species is only maybe 30 trillion human cells. So we're more microbial than human. That should stop us in our tracks and say, what? What's going on? These microbes literally create health or disease or death. And so this gut microbiome, which is very, very diverse when it's healthy, tells quite a bit to our system. And that variety of species, which is called alpha diversity, is critical. Because the more number of species, the more diversity of the gut microbiome we have, potentially pathogenic bacteria get crowded out and they do not become pathogenic, and therefore we don't have disease. So when there is a disruption of the microbiome in the gut for a variety of reasons, diet, chemicals, poor exercise, too much exercise, emotional stress, on and on and on. Mm-hmm. There is something going on where potentially pathogenic bacteria overgrow. The immune system is there to help us, and it reacts to this pathogenic overgrowth. And the pathogenic overgrowth with a variety of toxic elements in the gut damage the very thin epithelial barrier, which is only one cell layer thick. And when that damage occurs, the spaces between the cells open too wide and junk gets into the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. It's called a leaky gut. More formally, an increased intestinal permeability. But what leaks into the bloodstream is significant. It is normal food particles, right, but these particles have not broken down to their basic constituents. So the immune system looks at it and says, this is not us. This is foreign, and it's going to create a reaction. You may not be allergic to a food, but it, on an IgG test, it'll tell you you're allergic to it. Well, you're not. It's just that the bigger peptides cause the immune system to go crazy. Also, lipopolysaccharides, which are the gram-negative or the cell wall gram-negative bacteria, extremely toxic to the human body. That leaks into the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. All of that gets to any and every organ in our body, and that's what creates systemic chronic inflammation and creates chronic disease. And it creates cancer, it creates periodontal disease, and tooth decay. And the way it does that is that when this irregularity of the immune system and the toxic elements, especially of LPS, get involved with the mouth microbiome, which is made up of maybe 700 or so species, starts to change, and it can become pathogenic. So other bacteria that are potentially pathogenic in the mouth, which never cause a problem, and actually are there for a purpose to keep other bacteria in its proper state, then overgrow, and then the diet and other factors can cause the pathogenic bacteria to become create periodontal disease, create tooth decay. And once that happens, we have two nidus of infection. We have an infectious process leaking into the bloodstream from the gut, dysbiosis, and we have an infectious process leaking into the bloodstream from the mouth inflammation. And it just doesn't leak into the bloodstream. It gets into the lymph tissue that eventually gets into the bloodstream in the mouth. It can get into the coating of nerve tissues, which are the plastic coating of electric wires. And it can slide in and out of any area where the nerve fibers progress in the body without even getting into the bloodstream. Wow. It can get into the little capillary beds under the gum tissue to immediately get into the bloodstream. What it doesn't do very well is when we swallow this infectious material, it doesn't really get into the gut so much because the stomach acid kills that bacteria. But when it gets into the lymph and the bloodstream and the nerve fibers, the myelin sheath, this is the plastic coating of wires, it can get into every part of the body. So to answer your question in a longabout way, absolutely dysbiosis in the mouth causing tooth decay and or gum disease spreads to other areas of the body. Mm-hmm. But if you only treat the mouth infection and the gut inflammation is never understood, the source of that infection or inflammation continues and you'll never get treatment.
And so when you say biological dentists get it wrong, they're still looking from, I guess, the top down, if you will, and you're kind of looking from the gut up.
Well, they're looking from the most obvious place to see gut dysbiosis. It's very difficult to diagnose gut dysbiosis. There are blood tests. There are other tests. Mm-hmm. They have false positives, false negatives. But generally, the mouth is the best recipient of the damage from the gut. We can see all kinds of changes in the mouth. So a dentist that is very integrated, may look at the mouth and say, this is not normal tissue. It's too red. It's too inflamed. It's got coatings on it. Whatever, there are lesions in the mouth. Whatever is going on in the mouth is most likely a result of something going on in the gut. But when the dentist looks in the mouth, that's what he sees or she sees first of all. And logically, you would say, oh, these lesions in the mouth are causing other lesions in the body. Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. But I think, and from what I read, and I've done some extensive reading, I believe that we're dealing with the continuum of the chronic systemic inflammation emanating from the gut and manifesting in the mouth as well as other places in the body.
Hey guys, just to let you know, my Carnivore Cure book is back in stock. For 9 months, it was out of print and used prices were up to $300. Make sure to get your copy today that has over 200 colored tables and graphics and over 400 pages of meaty goodness. We have a limited supply, so get your copy today on Amazon.com. And if you can leave a review, I'd be super grateful.
And so how, when you bring this up to your patients, if you look in their mouth and you see these lesions or you see the bleeding tissue and the inflammation and you tell them this, I'm just curious, this is for my own personal questioning, but what is their response? Do you find people are receptive?
No, not at all. I would say 5% of the people are receptive. I have had patients, one in particular, which blows me away because he's a very well-known guy, come to the office with severe periodontal disease. And I explained to him, yes, you have severe periodontal disease, but we also need to look at your nutrition and what's going on in your gut, because I believe this is a major factor. He nodded his head. He looked at me like he was understanding what I said. When he went to the front desk, he said, I need to be referred to a real periodontist. Wow. So that's the interesting scenario. People don't want to understand the integration of the human body for some reason. That's the worst case scenario that I can imagine. But some of these people have said, this makes sense. And I've heard about this before. Now you're saying it again. And what we've done with these people is treat the mouth, but also attempt to treat the gut and change their diet. Not an easy task, but for those people that are proactive, their success is amazing.
And so, I mean, you always hear when you're or when you're reading that, you know, the mouth is kind of the window to the body, but really what you're saying is the mouth is a window to the gut, and the gut is what's causing all the issues in the body.
Well, let's be clear. Yes, the mouth is not the window, but a mirror of what's going on in the gut. And although I made the comment that the gut is the primary factor, it's not the only one.
Okay.
Because there can be problems in the mouth that initiate the infection in the mouth. For example, a broken tooth could irritate the gum and cause infection all by itself, just like a splinter in your finger didn't become infected because you had dysbiosis in the gut. You could have a tooth that became necrotic and dead, meaning that the nerve tissue and all the vital structures inside the pulp of the tooth have died and infection is pouring out from the base of the tooth, causing an abscess. And that abscess by itself can cause serious problems in the body without having any problem with the gut. You could have dental work that has cracked, you know, a filling that cracked, a crown that leaks and causes a source of bacterial infection all unto itself. You could have other issues relating to trauma in the mouth.
Right.
Be hit with a baseball bat and have other issues. So there are certain areas in the mouth that create its own, I would call splinters, creating inflammation all unto itself. But for the most part, when there is infection, and I've seen this many times, we have patients that needed to understand how to clean their mouth. We explain how to clean their mouth, and they clean their mouth very well, and they keep coming back. every 3 to 6 months, they still have bleeding gums. Right. Why do they have bleeding gums? Well, either I didn't diagnose the problem in the mouth correctly, meaning that something else was going on in the mouth itself that I didn't see, or I ignored the other problem from the gut that maintained inflammation in the mouth. So the person that is trying to treat the whole body must understand the mouth is a critical part, not necessarily originating the disease, but maybe exacerbating it, and it could be the originator of disease. But still, the gut and the mouth, as well as the diet, need to be looked at very, very closely.
And so from that example, would you say that it's really difficult if somebody has periodontal disease and they're just really diligent about flossing and brushing and doing all of those mitigation techniques that they've been taught by their dentist or their periodontist, and then still having that same issue, like you say, 3 or 6 months later? What I'm hearing from you is you can clean the mouth as diligently as you can, but still, if you're not addressing that underlying systemic issue, you're not going to have resolution.
100% correct.
Wow.
One of the clients that I discussed with that situation, and I do consultations literally all over the world. One guy had sent me a report. He was going to a dental school, which has a very good reputation in the periodontal department, for 2 or 3 years. And he sent me the clinical notes. They were seeing him every 3 months, and he had severe periodontal disease. And they kept repeating in the notes, reviewed oral hygiene, reviewed oral hygiene, reviewed oral hygiene. The guy said to me, I could write a book on how to brush and floss my teeth, which he did, which he could do. They completely failed to integrate the problems in his gut and in his diet. And there would lie the basic problem of his severe periodontal disease. Now, he had a bite problem. He had other issues that contributed to his problem, but it wasn't the real source. So, unfortunately, someone needs to look at the gut. And most physicians don't know anything about the mouth. They wouldn't even start to look at the mouth. And most dentists, even the biological ones, look at the mouth, and they understand the systemic manifestations of disease emanating from the mouth, but they don't realize it's only part of the continuum of the problem that started in the gut. Does that make sense to you?
It makes absolute sense. And I can imagine how frustrating it must be for a patient who is trying so hard and doing everything they're told and still not finding relief from the problem because they're not actually addressing the problem.
Without a doubt. There are so many elements to addressing the problem. Vitamin D levels are important. Vitamin A is important. Obviously, the diet is important. Certain foods that have anti-nutrients will not allow nutrients of other foods to get absorbed. Certain foods like the gluten grains attach to minerals in the mouth and doesn't allow natural remineralization. There are so many factors that need to be addressed, and it's just not one thing or the other thing. It's a lot of things. But you have to have a complete view.
And so when you tell your patients, those that come to you with a severe periodontal disease, what is the protocol that you give them to heal completely from this? And what are, you mentioned that there were several elements, and you mentioned just a few of them and talking about the vitamin D and the stress levels and the diet, but can you kind of walk us through what you would tell someone in terms of like what an actual protocol might look like?
Of course. First of all, I need to get educated to see what the problems may be. Obviously, I'm going to do an oral examination. Mm-hmm. That being said, I have them fill out a very complete and very unusual dental and medical questionnaire. Questions that you probably would never have even been asked by a medical doctor for me to get an understanding of what's going on in their body, what they feel like. I even have a question, if you had a magic wand, what three things would you change in your body? I want to get an understanding of what really is their problem. I also need to see a three-day food journal. Mm-hmm. I believe a three-day food journal should be part of every annual exam for every medical practice and dental practice. How can you understand the health of a person if you don't understand what they're putting in their body for three consecutive days? I don't understand how a person can come up with a diagnosis without knowing what's going in as fuel or what's not going in as fuel. And of course, the dental x-rays are critical. So I need the x-rays to look at things that may not cause pain or swelling in the patient, but I need to see susceptible or suspicious areas in the mouth, the jawbone, around the roots of the teeth, and a variety of other maybe potentially poorly healed extraction sites to figure out what might be going on. So let's say I see signs that maybe there's something inside the bone, but also their diet really is what I would consider not a healthy diet. So I try to explain to them, here's what we're going to do first. We are going to try to settle down this acute infection in your mouth. And there are procedures that almost every good dentist knows how to do that. And then we're also going to address these elements in your food journal that are very unhealthy for the body and unhealthy for the gut microbiome. Without a doubt, there are so many patients that take so many supplements. Most of them are synthetic, and many of them have inert ingredients that are not so inert. They're extremely damaging to the gut microbiome. I'm not a believer of all these supplements. I do believe in things that you may call supplements. I would call them desiccated foods, but they're not supplements in my mind. So if you can bring together these ideas that the diet needs to be tweaked, these things that you're eating are not healthy for the gut, and then here are some proven methods to help the gut microbiome get more healthy, more diversified, and those elements or areas where the gut epithelial barrier is leaking, certain things have been shown to help heal that leaky gut. I'm going to try to do simultaneously with the rest of the treatment of the mouth. And like I said, a few patients will agree, the majority would not agree.
And so when you do diet recommendations, what do you recommend?
Yes, I recommend. Well, here's how I view this. And this is how I educated myself. I look at a very broad perspective of human evolution. I believe in evolution. If you don't, okay. But I believe in evolution. Probably 2.5 million years of the human species of sort, certainly 300,000 years for Homo sapiens. There is a jaw that was recovered and dated to be 300,000 years old from Morocco. This individual had all their teeth in the bottom teeth of the bottom jaw, no bone destruction, no tooth decay, severe wearing of the teeth. I would suspect the individual was at least 28, 29, 30 years old or older. Junk between the teeth that was calcified, which is really dental plaque, causing no tooth decay and gum disease. So what I'm saying is that our human species has evolved with a healthy gut. And how did you get a healthy gut? They ate the foods that our species ate and has been well documented over this course of time. And it turns out that if we look at the physiology of our digestive system, it is designed to be an animal-based food source, not a plant-based food source. How do I know? Well, first of all, the acidity of the stomach is so low, so acid, that it destroys microbes, so it can't get into the gut to kill us. The small intestine is relatively long, meaning that's where most of the protein material would be absorbed. The colon, the large intestine, is relatively short. That's where all the plant material would be digested well. We're not eating a lot of plant material as a species. We have very little, if any, cecum in that area. So we have a situation where our physiology encourages us to be more animal-based or carnivore-ish than certainly herbivore-ish. And although we're omnivores, we lean towards eating meat. But not just meat. That's just one very small part. The organs are critical. The bone marrow is critical. Animal fat is critical. We know there's no cave paintings where these primitive people were eating Brussels sprouts. They were killing animals with clubs that they made. And they actually learned how to take the large bones and not crack them open, because the marrow was very, very idolized in these days. They would leave the bone marrow in the bone so it wouldn't spoil much. Mm-hmm. And when they were ready to eat them, they would crush the bones and eat the bone marrow. That fat is a critical element for the development of our brain. This is history that has been proven. Now, there are members of our society that would tell me I have no idea what I'm talking about. And these are people that support a plant-based diet 100%, and they're juicing and eating all these plants, and they say red meat will cause colon cancer, and which is totally incorrect, and that if you eat red meat, your blood becomes too acidic, which is totally incorrect. And so, unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation. But if we look at our species and find how they evolved, then you understand why a carnivore or a carnivore-ish diet is the diet of choice. To get to the answer to your question, a carnivore diet or a carnivore-ish diet.
And so that your answer brought up two more questions for me. So number one, so you're looking at these ancient Paleolithic time period jawbones, and you're seeing that there's some regular wear and tear, but there's no disease.
For the most part. Minimal.
And so when did that start? And also, did you notice like the narrowing of jaws, like, and how we came to have these kind of tiny, I'm looking at my face in the thing, like these tiny little narrow faces, as opposed to being able to accommodate all the teeth. And then number two, and we can come back to this one, but you talked about these jawbones that you found having the tartar in them. And I think that's something a lot of carnivores have. I know whenever I go to the dentist, she always behind my bottom front teeth is like scraping. And I don't have any gum disease, but it really builds up. And I've noticed that that's common in a lot of carnivores. I hear that from a lot of my clients. And so I'm curious why that happens. And if it's not dangerous, is it a big deal?
If you don't have active disease in your mouth, it's not a big deal. So calculus or tartar is a deposit of calcium and or other minerals that come from the fluid of the salivary glands, mm-hmm. basically on the inside of the lower front teeth, little two openings under the tongue from the submandibular salivary gland. And those minerals can precipitate. There are a variety of reasons why. You may not have enough vitamin D in your system, vitamin D3, okay. And not enough vitamin K2, which causes the calcium to go into bone rather than soft tissue. You may have been eating too many oxalates in your days of not eating a good carnivore diet. Oxalates do cause tartar or kidney stones deposits. That's a real possibility. So those are things that could be a factor. What was the first?
The first question was about when the teeth started changing.
Oh, yeah. Right. So if you look at some skeletal remains after the advent of farming. So farming started about 10,000 years ago, and then slowly farming started to produce processed grains and white flour and processed sugars, that's the time that you saw a significant increase in the prevalence of tooth decay and gum disease. These anti-nutrients in those foods did not allow a healthy microbiome in the gut, nor did it allow a healthy microbiome in the mouth. Now, the size of the jaw has a lot to do with the way you're born. Were you born vaginally and breastfed, or you were cesarean? And if either one, did you get a bottle within a week or within a couple months, within a year, or after 3 or 4 years of breastfeeding? So breastfeeding did some very, very fascinating things. When you breastfeed, the nipple presses, because of the suction that you do to get the milk out of the breast, the nipple presses up into the hard palate, the upper jaw. And the pressure allows the upper jaw to spread wider as it grows to accommodate the natural teeth. And of course, the nipple, the breast, accommodates to the changes. It's not static. So as the baby is growing, the nipple and breast continuously pushes the palate into its proper size. When the upper jaw is in its proper size and the teeth start to erupt, the lower jaw starts to accommodate to the size of the upper jaw. So that creates the shape of the jaw. Another thing that creates the shape of the jaw is the foods we eat after we're breastfed. Certainly, Cheerios and mush is not the way a child should eat. They need to eat animal-based foods that have some firmness to it. Even chewing on bones or gristle is a natural thing. And the pressure of the chewing stimulates the big muscles of the jaw, the masseters, to stimulate the bone of the jaw to widen and thicken. So that's why primitive man, especially some of the research by Dr. Price way back, showed that native peoples that did breastfeed, did eat off the land, did basically eat an animal-based diet, ate a lot of vitamin K2 foods, which would be the fats of animals, and they developed very, very healthy jaws. And those societies that became westernized and ate the soft foods and didn't have the vitamin K2 and the vitamin A retinol, not carotene, but retinol in the animal-based foods, had poor jaw development and other illnesses. So Weston A. Price was brilliant, did a phenomenal job with observational data. Interestingly, Weston A. Price has never been taught in a dental school. And I don't know why. Wow. I never learned of Weston A. Price until I learned about paleo, you know, 30 years after I was a dentist. It's kind of mind-boggling that this knowledge was kept under wraps. I don't know exactly the reason.
Yeah, that is a tragedy because there's a lot of information there that people could benefit from.
Absolutely.
For our expecting listeners and young mothers out there, what do you think is an optimal time for breastfeeding? Like how many years in order to get that really good jaw development? What would be your recommendation?
Well, I can only tell you what has been reported. 2 to 3 years certainly is not abnormal. Some people actually 4 years, certainly 2 to 3 months is inadequate.
Right. Okay. All right. That sounds good. And then another question I have. So you recommend a carnivore diet for your patients that have severe disease, and then you find that to be restorative. They can actually change the shape, not the shape, but they can change the outcome of disease in their mouth by doing a carnivore diet. So it can be preventative and it can be restorative in that way?
Correct. But let's not start with the mouth. Let's start with the gut.
Right.
So this diet is extremely beneficial to the gut microbiome and the health of the epithelial barrier and the robustness of the immune system, which is the reason you and I are either healthy or unhealthy. So yes, it does improve the mouth by way of the gut. And in addition, the foods that you're eating don't have the anti-nutrients and other byproducts of some of the bad or the poor food choices that stimulate potentially pathogenic bacteria.
And so how would you recommend people watching that are like, okay, I had no idea that my gut played such a huge role in my oral health. How do you, can you empower people who don't have access to a dentist who knows about gut health? How can they research and find this information for themselves so they can start seeing some healing occur?
Well, I do have a website and I write blogs literally every week. And there's be over 500 blogs in that website. So they can press a little search button, looks like a magnifying glass, type in a couple words like a gut microbiome, and every article that I've written that refers to a gut microbiome, they can look and read. All my articles have cited peer-reviewed medical research to back up everything I say. If I am saying something that is totally anecdotal, I explain that. But I don't make the statement, this is a cure for anything. I don't want anybody to get confused. I don't have a cure for cancer. I don't have a cure for chronic diseases. But I do have a method to improve anyone's immune system to become as robust as that person's ability allows. And that is the secret to health. So when I was diagnosed with incurable bone marrow cancer in 2018, and told I was given 3 to 6 months to live, I needed to start chemo immediately, it made no sense to me. It made no sense to me because, number one, chemo would have destroyed my already weakened immune system because of my bone marrow cancer. And I am not so confident that modern medicine knows how to repair an immune system for a lot of reasons. And so, and if this is incurable, why would I go through the chore? Now, my oncologist said, who's still my oncologist, said, well, if you did chemo, you would go into remission and you would live more than 3 to 6 months. But then he said very clearly, this would not cure your disease. Eventually, the chemo will not work. The disease will come back more with a vengeance. Mm-hmm. And we'd have to have more caustic chemo. I wasn't a good candidate for stem cells, and that's another interesting story in and of itself. And therefore, eventually, the chemo drugs would not work, and I would still die from what I have called multiple myeloma. The interesting thing is that as we go along, the quality of my life would deteriorate.
Right.
And I was very clear with him and my family, and they agreed with me, that quality of life is everything. So what I needed to do is figure out what I could do to support my immune system that was already damaged by a cancer I had no control over. And I can describe to you later why I think I got cancer. But in doing what I've done, I was able, pretty much able to maintain the quality of my life. And I've had some significant ups and downs, but and maintain the quality of my life without the disease overtaking me. I have multiple myeloma. I'm not in remission. And this cancer will kill me. And the worst thing that this cancer has done to date has damaged the internal structure of my bones. Mm-hmm. And therefore, this is true of multiple myeloma. So I have lots and lots of pathological fractures. I mean, lots and lots. I can bend the wrong way and I'll break a rib. That's how tender and sensitive my bone structure is. So to answer your question, this diet can do quite a bit of repair work or improvement of the immune system. And all you have to do is look again at primal ancestors that are long gone or primal societies, which are not very many, but a few primal societies that still live and exist today on predominantly an animal-based diet with none of the anti-nutrients or chemicals that we live in this civilized world. And they hardly have chronic disease, they hardly have cancer, and they hardly have gum disease or tooth decay.
So I just have a couple other dental questions for you, and then I'd like to get back because I think our listeners will be curious about why you think you developed cancer in the first place, which you alluded to. But so I have a question about dental amalgams. So do you recommend your patients remove those amalgams if they have them?
I say absolutely, and I could lose my license because of that.
That's true, yeah.
So let me explain this to you. The American Dental Association used to have a patent on dental amalgams. So there's a little bit of a conflict of interest. They don't have that patent anymore from what I understand. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has yearly announced that there is no proof that dental amalgams cause disease. That's a very interesting statement. Much of Europe has already decided mercury fillings are not healthy. So, would you drink a glass of water that you knew had toxic elements in it? If you knew had chemicals that are poisonous in it? And if you would, how much would you drink of it? Would 1/1,000,000th of a particle be concerning to you, or 100,000 particles of that toxic element? In my mind, if you know something is toxic, why have it in your body at all, especially if you have control over it? So mercury fillings, without a doubt, leach free mercury gas to different extents in different people, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's toxic. Why should you put that in your body? Therefore, my opinion is, if you have the mindset and understanding that mercury fillings potentially leach free mercury that can be toxic, then get the mercury filling out and replace it with a biocompatible material. That's what I would suggest.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it has to be removed correctly.
Yes.
Because if it's not removed correctly, there's more damage in removing it incorrectly than leaving it in place. Because if it's not removed correctly, all the free mercury becomes volatilized immediately, and you breathe it in, and it gets absorbed under your tongue, goes right into your bloodstream. You'll get a very high dose of mercury poisoning.
And are there, once you have those mercury fillings out, is there a detox protocol you go through?
Well, there are a variety of people that have different protocols.
Okay.
Many people suggest you rinse with binding type of chemicals that will bind to any excess free mercury that might be in the mouth, as long even if it's done correctly. So that's more protective, like activated charcoal, which I don't recommend unless for this procedure. Chlorella has been used as a rinse to help bind to some of the toxic elements. So different people have different protocols, and all of that makes sense, just to be on the cautionary side.
Okay. And then I'm curious about your opinion of root canals. Those are pretty controversial. Some people are just like, never, you should never have dead tissue left in your body. And most dentists, though, recommend them still. What is your opinion of root canals? Should they just get the tooth pulled?
So you're right. Dead tissue is not necessarily what your body wants to have in it. Your body is designed to literally exfoliate dead tissue in a variety of ways. So if you have a tooth that has an abscess and you have a endodontist who's a specialist in root canals, or a general dentist who thinks he or she knows how to do them well, try to remove the infectious material and put an inert filling material into the tooth. In all logical sense, that should be okay, because now the tooth, even though it's dead, nothing necrotic is still in the tooth. The fact is, it never happens that way, because there are microscopic tunnels that go between the pulp of the tooth, where all this nerve tissue is, and now all this infected necrotic material is, to the outside of the root, not just at the base of the root. there are thousands of microscopic tunnels that more than comfortably can house bacteria. So when the root canal is done and the material is used to fill in the pulp chamber where the dead tooth structure was, the method to sterilize these microscopic tubules has never been perfected, in my opinion. And other teeth that have had root canals that have been extracted and they've been looked at under a microscope show signs of leaching of this infection into what's called the periodontal ligament space. This is the attachment of the root to the bone with little ligament fibers, almost like a hammock attaches to two trees. And those fibers allow this infectious material to get into the bloodstream directly. And the immune system is fighting this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if you're talking about a robust immune system, meaning one that is very efficient in treating disease, but it's fighting a fight that it can never win, it becomes somewhat of a debilitated army and it can't do its job effectively. So the bottom line, in my opinion, is if the tooth is abscessed, extract it. Okay. If you had a root canal and there are any signs of damage around the root of the tooth, extract it. Now, if you have a tooth like the front tooth, perfectly normal, healthy front tooth, and you're unfortunate enough to have a baseball hit you in the mouth, or you fell off a bike and you cut and the tooth literally broke in half at the gum line, perfectly vital tooth, two things can happen. There are ways that are more investigative today than completely understood, but there are ways to regenerate a nerve of the tooth if it's not completely dead. That's a possibility. If that's not the possibility, but the tooth has been fractured in half and you have a literally healthy pulp, but it's not going to stay healthy for long, you could have a root canal, meaning the nerve of the tooth and all the vessels removed. There's no necrotic tissue. There is no dead cells or infection or pus in that area. So there are no tubules to sterilize, per se. And do a very well done root canal, that type of a root canal might work. In other words, if you have a fractured tooth and it is a vital, healthy, living tooth with one canal, that might work. If it is a bicuspid with two roots, or a lower molar with two roots or an upper molar with three roots, and it's fractured like that, I would lean towards extracting the tooth because those nerves are very difficult to negotiate. The roots are very not straight. They have some very interesting angles that are difficult to negotiate with a root canal filling. And the question would be, is it going to fail? And the answer is most likely it will fail. But between the root canal and it fails, the infection is pouring into the body 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So generally, necrotic teeth, extract and prepare properly for maybe an implant. If you're going to do an implant, make sure it's a zirconia type and not a titanium type implant for a variety of other reasons. Titanium is not kind to the immune system, and or not replace it at all, depending on which tooth has to be extracted.
Okay, good advice. Thank you. I'm sure a lot of our listeners, including my husband, will appreciate. And then the last question, something that you alluded to, and I'm sure our listeners are curious, as am I, why do you think that you developed multiple myeloma?
Great question. So I'm very geeky, as you probably got already. And so when I was diagnosed, my first question to myself was, how can I get this cancer? I've been on a paleo diet with living a paleo lifestyle for 6 or 7 years prior to the diagnosis. That should preclude me from ever having cancer. Unfortunately, that's not a true statement. You didn't get cancer today because it started yesterday. Right. You got cancer today because it started decades ago, and it's hard to grasp that concept. So I found a paper that was published by a Brazilian researcher, and it was an observational paper, not a controlled study. But what he did, which to me was amazing, he looked at males who were dentists in my age group, 65 to 75, I think it was, and he looked at the general male population, 65 to 75. And he found that the general male population did not have a significant level of multiple myeloma, but male dentists did. They had a significantly high prevalence of multiple myeloma. Now, how could that be? So when I, and his paper didn't discuss that. So when I started to figure out what happened to me as a dental student that was so different than every other guy in the world. And in dental school, I knew and learned how to place mercury fillings. And by the way, every dental school still teaches that. It's required. And I was exposed to low-dose ionizing radiation, which are dental x-rays. So when we place mercury fillings in the mouth, which we did continuously, 4 years of dental school, 2 years of graduate school in a dental environment, we literally played with the mercury in our hands like kids play with Play-Doh today. And it's beautiful. It's silvery. It's a, it's an astonishing material. And when you throw it on the floor, these little gold, silver beads get smaller and smaller and disappear. Well, they evaporate. The atmosphere in every dental school in the country, probably the world, that used mercury fillings had the most toxic air in its buildings. No one knew that. And mercury is a highly toxic material that could have caused one of my plasma cells to go malignant. The other thing is, low-dose ionizing radiation, which are dental x-rays, has been shown to cause multiple myeloma. Not because you went to the dentist to get dental x-rays. It's because you were exposed over and over and over again. In a dental environment, we had a clinic where there were four dental students that shared a dental x-ray machine, and we had 120 dental students. There were a lot of dental x-ray machines, and they were going on and off all the time in different time frames, and you didn't know they were on and off unless you saw the red light go on or the green light go on. It didn't make a noise, didn't make an odor. Sometimes we had badges that showed excessive radiation, but I don't know that it was emphasized. I don't even remember wearing one. So it's possible that both of these toxic elements cause one plasma cell, just one, in my body to change to the point where it became cancerous. Mm-hmm. And my immune system, for one reason or another, didn't identify it, so it didn't kill it. And the cell that did change didn't understand the change and didn't create what's called apoptosis, which is suicide of the cell. The cell kills itself off. That one cell, over time, multiplied. And what a malignancy is that it's a non-functional cell that keeps growing and growing and or duplicating itself. And after 4 or 5 decades, I had a full-blown case of multiple myeloma. Maybe my paleo diet and lifestyle kept it at bay for a longer period of time, but it never arrested the disease. And it's incurable.
That's really interesting. And I just think it's so unfortunate that it's still happening today.
Sure.
With everything that we know. That's it's a real, that's a travesty. I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, cancer is the second leading cause of death in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it is a disease of environmental factors.
Yes.
It is a disease of metabolic dysfunction and mitochondrial dysfunction. It's not a genetic disease. You may have a genetic predisposition to a malignancy, but you can down-regulate that gene if your diet and lifestyle choices support down-regulating that gene. So you'll never have that malignancy. That's true of all kinds of other chronic diseases. Just because there's a genetic malfunction in our body doesn't mean we are prone or guaranteed the disease. Our body is pretty brilliant, and it knows how to circumvent things. And if one system or pathway isn't working right, there are many other pathways that can take control. The problem is you have to give the body the nutrients it needs in a bioavailable form, and you must avoid everything and anything that prevents that or damages the gut microbiome. And if you do those two things, I would say you'd be a pretty healthy person.
That's great advice. That's really good advice, and I appreciate that. This has just been a treasure trove of knowledge, and I just really appreciate you taking the time to visit with us and let us into your brain a little bit. I know you talked about it very briefly earlier, but will you remind listeners where they can find your website to Sure. have access to all your information?
Absolutely. It's drdanenberg.com. So it would be spelled drdanenberg.com.
Fantastic. Well, I can tell that you're just very caring and such a kind soul, and I'm so glad that you were here with us today, and I really appreciate it.
Okay, guys, I hope you enjoyed this interview. This is just really a tribute to Dr. Al Dannenberg for all the work that he has done and just for being the soul that he was that wanted to help people to better health, especially because he went through it himself. Consider taking care of your oral health. I know it is not cheap. We have people in the service community that need to redo either cavitations or root canals, and it's a lot of work and it's costly, but it really comes down to what is your life worth. And I think Dr. Al Dannenberg talks about the importance of oral health. Okay, guys, I hope this interview brings you closer to better health. I will link to Dr. Al Dannenberg's website and his book so that if you want to support him and his family, you know where to find him. Okay, guys, make sure to eat a lot of meat, take care of your bodies and your oral health, because it's the only place you have to live. I will talk to you later. Bye, guys. Thanks for listening to the Nutrition with Judy podcast. If you liked what you heard today, please make sure to leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app so more listeners like you can find the show. If you want more practitioner care and support, head over to nutritionwithjudy.com/groups so you can get more real talk about carnivore, the environment, and root cause healing. You can also find my content on Nutrition with Judy's YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Make sure to sign up for my weekly newsletter and learn more about in-depth articles with infographics at nutritionwithjudy.com/articles. You can find my two books, Carnivore Cure and The Complete Carnivore Diet for Beginners, on carnivorecure.com and amazon.com. At the heart of Nutrition with Judy's practice, our mission lies with a deep, unwavering passion for service and community. We will continue to empower you to have the knowledge and tools to live a life nearly symptom-free, because we firmly believe in healing and wellness for all.